Okay. My name is Barry Tyker, and today is May 20th already, 1996. I'm in the WHA studio with Paul Ginsberg, who has had a long association with the university, including a relatively long stay, was it not, as Dean of Students?
I was Dean of Students for about 17 plus years.
That's a long time.
A long stay.
Yeah. Is that a record? Oh, no, Scott Goodnight, of course, has the record that no one will ever touch. What am I talking about?
He was here forever.
Yes.
Yes.
Today we're going to be talking a little bit about your deanship and a little bit about the context of the times that you were during which you were here at the university. We're doing two tapes for broadcast. One is on the university in the 50s, and one is on the university in the 60s. So the logical place to start, of course, is in the 50s. Discuss briefly, if you would, the lead-up to the 50s, namely the end of the war, the post-war years. Just kind of describe the atmosphere on campus and your involvement in it, in whatever capacity.
I need to put that into a context of when I came here.
You need to put...
I need to put the question of what kind of factors were evolving and developing in the 50s that led to the times of the 60s, the changes, etc. But the context of that is I arrived here in 1951, coming here from a three-year stay in Israel, after completing about 2.5 years of undergraduate work at Michigan State, which followed, going to Michigan State followed, my 3.5 years in the Army during the Second World War. So I arrived here in 51. I might add parenthetically that my choice of Michigan State, Barry, had little to do with educational standards. They had a wonderful accelerated program for veterans. So in 2.5 years, I was able to complete all but, I think, 8 or 9 undergraduate credits.
Part of that GI Bill.
Part of the GI Bill.
By the way, you don't have to refer to me as Barry because that would have to be cut out.
Okay.
I'm sort of anonymous. You can talk to me, address me as Mr. Anonymous if you'd like.
But what I remember most about the 50s, one, the veterans on campus accelerated everything. Most of the veterans at Michigan State and also here on campus at University of Wisconsin-Madison were in a hurry. The underlying pressures to make up for the time you missed. And most of us were concentrating on getting through and getting out. I like to say in retrospect we were interested in getting an education, but I think that was probably a little bit lower on the priority table. What struck me when I came here was the fact that I was surrounded in great part by students my age. When I came to campus in 1951, I was already 27 years old. I was also struck by the fact that we saw the beginnings of the student power movement. We saw the beginnings of the reaction to the concept of in loco parentis, of parental regulations. And I don't think this was a philosophical issue for most of us. We didn't object to the philosophical concept of in loco parentis. We objected to the implementation of it. We were looking for an environment, clearly, most of us were looking for an environment that did not include restraints and constraints, parental standards, if you please. And certainly if you look back at the 50s on this campus, you began to see the beginnings of the student power movement.
Could you talk a little bit about what ways those beginnings, you started to see those beginnings?
In 2 or 3 ways, but I need quickly.
Start to see.
If you look at the beginnings of the student power movement, if you look at the point at which students began saying, we want to be heard and not only seen, we want to be an equal partner in the dynamic process of running university. It began on this campus with, oddly enough, a group primarily white young Republicans. The conservative movement, the conservative students, mostly members of young GOP, who began asking questions like parietal regulations, women's hours. You might recall at that time when women came to campus, they had hours and were required to live in residence halls. And part of women's hours was they had to be in, I think, by 10:30 or 11, Monday or Sunday through Thursday. And on weekends, they could stay out till 11:30 or 12 o'clock. If you can believe it, certainly in comparing the stresses and strains of the anti-war years, when students were expelled for, if you please, firebombing a car, women students were actually expelled for violating women's hours in that time. Questions like visitation, which now students take in stride and make an assumption that we've always had visitation where members of the opposite sex can visit each other in residence halls without any constraints. Questions of search and seizures, this is what it was called at the time, when the university, through residence halls, had the authority to search any room at any time at its own initiative, without, if you please, good cause, without there being a smoking gun. This also preceded by about, I think, 5 or 6 years, what I think was a significant point in the development of a disciplinary code in Madison and the opening of the university to students, was the judicial ruling in the case of Soglin. Sounds familiar? Paul Soglin, who's now mayor in Madison, was a student activist at the time and went to court to challenge a finding of guilt in a case of disorderly conduct. And the case is seen in the records now in the archives as Soglin versus Kaufman, Joseph Kaufman then being dean of students. And the findings of that case resulted in the decision that university rules and regulations were simply too vague and too arbitrary. Ironically enough, the judge that made the decision was Judge James Doyle Sr., the father of the current Attorney General in the state of Wisconsin. The rules were wonderful at that time if you simply want to look at them in terms of administering them. From a dean of students' point of view, they had some wonderful advantages. The rules were, in effect, be good, and the dean will tell you when you're bad. Little or no due process. So a combination of the beginnings of the student power movement with people like Steve Barney and Peter Peszek, who were both active in Republican circles, and Peter Peszek subsequently an attorney representing environmental causes in the state of Wisconsin, began questioning our freedom to enter their rooms, began questioning the parietal regulations, hours for women, and began questioning the legal validity, the constitutionality, if you please, of the rules and regulations. And the assumption one always makes in the state of Wisconsin is we often refer to those outside agitators or the left, but in truth, the movement began on this campus by a group of young idealists who happened to be conservative and happened to be Republican.
And could you say that same statement again, and could you put it in a time context like the early 50s or mid-50s?
The student power movement, the movement that began to look at the regulations that govern student life, really began in the mid-50s, perhaps 55, 56, and in residence halls, led by young Republicans, led by young conservatives who were beginning to, if you please, use the system to challenge the system by questioning the validity and constitutionality of a number of rules and regulations governing women's hours, visitation, issues like searching student rooms and the like.
Now, what were you doing in the mid-50s on campus?
I was a staff member in university residence halls. I became a house fellow in 1951, quite by accident. I joined the staff full-time in 1953 as a member of what they then called the social educational staff. I was in charge of the men's program, the social education, the student activities, and the counseling, and in charge of the House Fellow program.
Okay, I have to ask you, how did you become a House Fellow by accident?
One Saturday afternoon, I was sitting in my room in Bashford House in Tripp Hall, listening to Texaco opera, and it was actually La Boheme, and in comfortable clothing, and there was a knock on the door. It was a house fellow from Tarrant House, Lou Ebert, who asked me whether I'd be interested in applying for a house fellow position. There is no question in my mind that had I time to ponder that question, the answer would have been no. But I didn't ponder it, and I said, sure, I'll walk over with you, and I walked across the street with him to the conference room in Schlichter Hall, where they had a House Fellow Committee screening candidates. And I sometimes hesitate, but I do anyway, think about what would happen had it been a nice warm day and I'd been walking on Picnic Point instead of being in my room. But that's how I became a House Fellow.
Well, you know, it's really funny because I remember when I interviewed Larry Halley, and he came back after the war, and his wife was living with a bunch of other girls, mm-hmm. and he couldn't find a room, and Don Halverson said, why don't you take, he was going to have to go to law school, he said, why don't you take over Badger Village for a couple months, just kind of, you know, get your room and all that stuff, and as Larry said afterwards, the rest was history.
It was history.
Like this housing thing.
When I joined the staff of residence halls, people like Larry Halley, George Gerda, Lee Burns, Newell Smith, Ferd Hintz, and many others had already been there 15 years. Very little turnover and incredible commitment.
And which is partly, I would say, the reason for the success is the stability of that upper management.
Yes.
At least that's what it seems like.
Yes.
I've interviewed every one of those people except for
Ferd Hintz.
Ferd Hintz. I've never met him. Mm-hmm.
I think another reason for the success of residence halls was Don Halverson's insistence that all of the operation be under one roof. Most universities have a separate physical plant program, a separate food service program, and a separate student program. Don Halverson, along with the support of people like Harold Bradley and Otto Kowalki and Scott Goodnight and others, insisted that all be under one roof, so people talk to each other.
Smart guy. Mm. I interviewed him, too. He was interesting.
Yes, he was.
Let's get back to your House Fellow days. You talked about search and see that people could go into other people's rooms mm-hmm. for whatever reason. Can you give any, were you involved in any of these searches or seizures, or could you give any specific examples of how that, what might make them want to do that?
Information that we may have received about theft, information that we may have received about having illegal possessions like a cooker or a hot plate, any other information that we had, or we, as a matter of rule and good administration, would schedule visits to student rooms simply to check the safety of facilities. Currently, as you know, in the city of Madison, I'm sure many other communities, an owner has to notify a tenant of when they're coming even to inspect. I don't remember any significant incident where the search and seizure policy saved lives or put out fires. It was simply a matter of this is the way it was always done. And it was done that way until students began to challenge it. It was not a question of specific kinds of situations. It was a matter of deep principle that these young men, primarily young men, felt. And I need to, when I talk about residence halls at that time, in the 1950s and early 60s, there were two distinct operations, in a sense. There were men's halls and women's halls. And there was kind of a Gaza Strip in between. There were two separate staffs. And later on, if I get a chance to talk a little bit about Martha Peterson, she deserves a great deal of credit for facilitating, expediting that bringing together of the programs in residence halls. So most of my experience in the 50s had to do with men's residence halls. It's difficult not to really get carried away when one talks about residence halls of the 50s and early 60s, because you're talking of a very controlled situation. You're talking about the women's halls having house mothers and not young residence halls managers or student affairs coordinators, where the training for women house fellows in the 50s included how to host a tea, how to be a good hostess at a faculty luncheon or a faculty tea, where the major problems, in retrospect, were Thursday and Friday night beer bashes. Drinking has not suddenly become a problem in the university. It's been a problem for as long as I've been here, where the concerns were panty raids and water fights. How longingly we looked back in the 60s to those days when we were worried about panty raids and water fights and not fire bombs.
You're giving me kind of a good old days reflection, which I can understand and appreciate. Do you think that those days were that good? I mean, did the people at that time pay a price for this kind of control, or do you think that basically it was something that that was basically a good system?
When you look back at the 50s and you think about the Ozzie and Harriet portrayals or Leave It to Beaver, those were the vehicles through which a notion of Camelot was reinforced. Everybody was happy. Everyone solved their problems. Nobody had major issues to deal with. It was the Rachel Carsons, the David Reismans, I think his first name is David, in the Lonely Crowd, the scientists who began discussing whether or not scientists should be socially responsible for how their scientific inventions are used. For example, should a scientist who discovered the atomic bomb be held responsible for how that bomb was used? So it were the Rachel Carsons, the Paul Reismans and others, the David Reismans and others, who were reminding us, although we didn't hear very carefully, that all is not well in Camelot. It is only in retrospect that we now realize that they were beginning to give us the signals. The university is basically a reactive animal. It is not a proactive animal. And I can't account for all the hair I've lost on my head, but half of it is attributable to the fact that we are mostly proactive, not reactive. Had we listened carefully to the voices of these young conservative students in the 50s, we might have avoided some of the problems we faced with black students, with the rebellious students in the anti-war years that we were facing in the 60s and early 70s. Had we listened more carefully in the 50s to those who were beginning to question our policies, not our motives. The protesters in the 60s and early 70s were questioning our motives. They were questioning our soul. And I had some difficulty with that. But the ones in the 50s were simply questioning our policies. And had we learned better how to communicate then, we might have avoided some of the problems that we face in the 60s and 70s.
That is very interesting. Why the conservatives? Why would they have been the ones who... And also, as far as you know, once you've answered that, was this something else that was going on at the University of Michigan or at University... Are you aware of it going on in other places? Or is this pretty much a UW phenomenon? And if so, why?
My sense, it's a UW phenomenon at that time. My sense is that other than some of the small liberal arts progressive schools like Antioch, for example, at that time, we were in the forerunner. Some people may question whether the forerunner is an appropriate word to use, we were in the far, we were in the forefront, if you please, of changing parental regulations. There are many words that we never heard in the dialogue of the 50s. We didn't hear about rebels. We didn't hear words of radicals. We certainly, until the 60s, never heard the pejorative phrase out-of-state radicals, for example. One of the other things we seldom heard about were what was the phenomenon of the libertarian mind, the libertarian mindset, which is truly a conservative mindset. And these young men were very much committed to the libertarian mindset. They who govern least govern best, and trust us, were words we often heard from the young men in the 50s who wanted us to change some of the rules and regulations that we had. In retrospect, and much of what we've learned is in retrospect, sadly enough, in retrospect, had we dealt with them on a philosophical issue, on the issue of student involvement in governance of the university, had we dealt with them on the philosophical issue of what is the appropriate role for students in this governance, we might have learned, without the pain and the angst that developed in the 60s, how to deal with student rebellion.
Why didn't you listen to them?
There's a tendency to answer that question of why we didn't listen to them with a kind of a tongue-in-cheek flip answer. We didn't know any better. We didn't take them seriously enough. I'd like to also think that they didn't ask the questions in such a way as to direct us toward the real philosophical issues they were dealing with. And we, as an administration, and I don't think this is unique to most administrations, we dealt with the symptoms and not the underlying philosophical questions. So we were asked to deal with searches of rooms, with parental regulations, with dress codes. Every night we had a dress and coat and tie. That's why I loved being a house fellow and a head fellow, because I could circumvent that rule. So what we did is take the easy way out and only dealt with the symptomatic questions they were asking and never the underlying philosophical questions they were dealing with.
Now, this is a side of the UW that I really wasn't familiar with, and I'm very interested in what you're saying. For the majority, I mean, you had a good pulse on the university as a house fellow and as your job at student personnel. Would you have characterized the University of Wisconsin-Madison as more or less a liberal institution in the 50s, using whatever the term liberal meant in that time frame?
I would not have classified the University of Wisconsin as liberal in the 50s. But again, I need to put that in the context. I don't classify the University of Wisconsin as liberal in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, or 90s, for that matter. We are basically a conservative institution. I don't classify Madison as a liberal institution, as a liberal city. I would kid my friend Paul Soglin that I think he is more conservative than I am. He understands the dynamics of institutional policy far better than I ever did. Where I think we confused the perception of this campus in the 50s, 60s, and 70s is we tended to confuse liberalism with openness, with willingness to tolerate, and not only tolerate, but to encourage diversity. We're a wonderful place for the people who are different. That's why I think this campus has so many fringe people, if you please. I use the word fringe not in a pejorative sense. But I don't think we've ever been a liberal institution. May I put that in the context again? I want you to imagine for a moment, and I may have mentioned this to you before, you read in the newspaper that the University of Wisconsin system is considering providing its faculty and staff the right to organize into labor unions. One would make an kind of an a priori assumption that places like Stevens Point and Superior and River Falls and Platteville would be those opposing it, and the great liberal institution, University of Wisconsin-Madison, would be endorsing it. Nonsense. Just the opposite. It is this university that has fought tenaciously and successfully to prevent unionization of its faculty and staff, and the institutions on the periphery of the system, Platteville, Superior, and the like, are those who have supported it. And what angers me personally, and very strongly and very deeply, is not whether or not I would have voted for unionization, because for many years I would have voted against it, because I believe we were a family, and families don't need unions. But what I objected to was I was being denied the right to vote by a combination of the university and its power that has diminished over the years, but it was powerful then, and the governor. But I don't think we're a very liberal institution. Basically, we have a conservative faculty, and I think we've had a very conservative administration.
Well, let's talk about the administration, the administrator who guided us through a good part of the 50s. Matter of fact, took over near the close of the war, and that's E.B. Frey. everybody always kind of gives a different reaction to E.B. Frey, but yours is, I think, pretty typical. Tell me a little bit about President Frey and his stay here at the university and your feelings toward his presidency.
There's a man who I deeply loved. E.B. Frey was a man who I deeply loved, deeply respected. His wife's name was Rosa. They lived in a house on campus right across the street from Schlichter Hall in the Lakeshore Halls area. So we saw a great deal of them while I was on the staff of residence halls. They would come to the dining hall every Sunday for dinner. That may be the only day that students looked forward to dressing up to be with the Freds. They were congenial. They reflected the traditional, perhaps typical Southern hospitality and generosity and goodness. If not for E.B. Frey, there would be a residence halls on the shore of Lake Mendota between the current Tripp Hall and Elizabeth Waters Hall. Can you imagine that? I shudder when I think of that. But he, E.B. Frey himself, said, "My words, not his, you will not desecrate any more forest land. You will not desecrate any more land to build another residence halls." Dr. Frey fought for years the desire to put television antennas on all the buildings, because he did not want to be on a campus where on the top of beautiful Bascom Hill, you looked over the horizon and all you saw were television antennas. You would often, on a spring day or a summer day, hear him calling his wife. He was downstairs, perhaps she was upstairs, and he had a powerful voice. There was another reason that I think E.B. Frey was very important at this university. He may have been the first, although I'm not sure, Ag Dean, College of Agricultural Product, to come into the leadership of this university. And I thought he brought an important perspective. It may or may not be true that E.B. Frey was the first president or chancellor from the Ag School, but I thought that he brought an interesting kind of a ground-oriented perspective. I do not want to do him a disservice when I say he was not an intellectual. He was a commoner's chancellor. I'm reminded, parenthetically, of this tragedy in Washington when the chief of naval operations recently committed suicide. And he was described as coming up from the ranks, as being initially a seaman and achieving the highest position in the Navy. That was the feeling about E.B. Frey, that he was one of us. The kids in residence halls were uncommonly comfortable with him. Many of us in the administration who are always in awe of chancellors, we're in awe of him, our presidents, but not the students. When he left the presidency or chancellorship and moved out of that house on the in the Lakeshore area, we were interested in taking over that house to have it become a Dean of Students retreat for meetings and the like. We lost. But I have very fond memories of him.
Now, I always think of E.B. very positive sense, kind of the last of the old school presidents of the university, and that after that things just got modern in a hurry. And I'm not making a judgment on it. You know, Elvium and Harrington, and you know, the things started moving faster. I'm fascinated with what you said because it sounds so much like something the presidents in the 19th century would have done about E.B. Fred coming to these and his wife coming to these Sunday afternoon or evening dinners. Just talk about that for another minute and tell how what it was like, where they sat, you know, if you were in on what they talked about. Just kind of describe that situation.
When you think of E.B. Fred and Rosa Fred, you think of the notion, at least the notion that goes to my mind is, Mr. Chips, where are you? Certainly, and editorially, I might add, it seems to me that E.B. Fred was, for me, the last apolitical president we had. Because, and in, this is not a meant to be a pejorative or derogatory statement about the Elviums, the Harringtons, and all those who followed, but the political climate here changed. I'm sure that was a factor. But E.B. Fred would come in, and Rosa Fred would come in, would talk about the meal, would smile gently. I remember vividly when students would say, how come we always have such good meals when you're here? And, well, that's the way the game is played, perhaps. We'll talk about the house. We'll take students on a tour of the house. We'll talk about the gardens. We'll talk about, and I can't remember where he and Rosa came from, but talk about their home growing up. If I were to summarize those interactions between the Freds and the students in residence halls, and if you were listening only to a tape and not seeing who they are, you never assume this was a university president and this was his wife. I have a feeling, I had a feeling, I still have a feeling, that she was never quite comfortable as the wife of the president. And she did far better, it seems to me, in terms of my interaction with her, when she was with small groups of students. But that may be projecting my own discomfort in social situations, I don't know. But I remember him well with great love and great admiration.
He's from Virginia, by the way, and a Virginia gentleman. And I believe it was his father or his grandfather who was the owner or trainer of Traveler, Robert E. Lee's horse.
I'll be darned.
Civil War. Huh. So he has a real deep and strong Southern background, which he left.
There is a phrase that I'm using in the memorial statement about Ralph Hansen that I'd mentioned to you earlier that I'm working on. But the same phrase applies to E.B. Fred, a gentleman and a gentleman. I'm very fond of him.
Now, we have another very interesting character, a very interesting person entering the scene in UW in the late 1950s, I believe it was. I'm talking about Martha Peterson.
Yes.
And she brings... Am I wrong in stating that she sort of brings a more modern approach toward things? Am I mischaracterizing her by that?
No. I think if I were to ever complete my book on understatements, I would include your statement about the advent of Martha Peterson on this campus as bringing more modern approaches. In many ways, she was a windstorm from Kansas. I do not know where Martha Peterson came from originally, but she came here from Kansas as Dean of Women. A very powerful person. I first met her because when Martha Peterson came to campus, I was still in residence halls. And I first met her when she was a member of the residence halls faculty committee. And to this day, I cannot tell you precisely what the issue was before the committee, but I made a comment to the committee that I don't, for the moment, see how I can work within a policy of that kind. And as we were leaving the meeting, she gently whispered to me, "Paul, that's a risky statement to make publicly." She's just powerful. She probably, as much as anyone, began the emphasis or the thrust toward making this a men's and a women's campus, and not simply a men's campus and a women's campus. Probably more than anyone began that difficult, painful process of evolving a dean of students' office and no longer a dean of men's and dean of women's office. She more than anyone saw, and I think she would smile if she were to hear this, she saw the folly of spending all the time we spent on women coming home at 10:35 instead of 10:30. She also began that movement toward student empowerment. My guess is that Martha Peterson will never get the credit she deserves for being a catalyst to that movement and not an obstacle. I live in a glass house. None of us deal effectively with change. Philosophically, we can talk about the importance of change as long as it's happening at another campus or some other place. But Martha was not threatened by change at all. So many of the significant changes in terms of the division of student affairs or student personnel life on this campus, many of the parental regulations began to change effectively under her. I remember a few years prior to her coming, this was probably the late 50s, when Dean Troxell was Dean of Women. And I'm blocking on her first name at this moment. But I remember seeing her about the issue of women's hours and parental regulations. And I came to her in her office in Lathrop Hall and sat down, gently intimidated. And I began raising the question to her, and she did two things very quickly. She reminded me, Louise Troxell was her first name. She reminded me that men do not become pregnant, and she changed the subject. When I went back to residence halls, and Lee Burns was then director, and I told him about it, and I said to Lee Burns, "Lee, she didn't even discuss it with me." And Lee smiled and said, "Oh, yes, she did, Paul." So when you mentioned in the context of Martha Peterson's coming to this campus, whether it was simply coincidence and these things were evolving and going to be evolving no matter who came here, or whether they were evolving because Martha Peterson had it in her mind that we need to start changing and moving forward, she deserves a lot of credit. It doesn't mean she didn't drive me up the wall once in a while, or that I didn't drive her up the wall once in a while. But I do think that she deserves a lot of credit for that.
Now, you were dean of men at this time?
No.
Not yet.
I was never dean of men.
Oh, you just went into dean of
dean of students.
Because she was, did she eventually become dean of students then?
She became dean of students after leaving the dean of women's position, and then for a period of time moved to system administration, the central administration. And whether she literally moved there or not, I can't recall, but assumed a kind of a central system student affairs position. Consistent in terms of time with Martha Peterson's arrival on campus, student affairs was going through significant changes. We had a dean of men and a dean of women. For a while, we had a dean of men, dean of women, and a dean of students. Person like Ed Drake for a while, who was director of counseling service and then dean of students, or Leroy Luberg, who was dean of students. But there was the underlying kind of a sense that was very noticeable, that if we're in the process of changing student life into a men's and women's campus combined, we ought to change student affairs life and student personnel life. There were some extremely difficult times in trying to make this a combined campus. We decided sometime, perhaps early 50s, mid-50s, to move women from Chadbourne Hall on the corner of Park and University Avenue to Schlichter Hall, which is located in the heart of the Lakeshore area on the west end of campus. The precipitant, sometimes we do things, write things for the wrong reasons. The precipitant wasn't the philosophical one. The precipitant was the fire department, fire safety office, saying you either rebuild Chadbourne or tear it down. So we moved women from Chadbourne into Schlichter Hall, which was located in the heart of the men's halls area, and the most outrageous thing they were going to do at the time was eat in the same dining hall with men. We received hundreds of letters from people questioning whether this was the end of our civilization. Now, what were we doing to the morals of young men and young women? So when we began talking about changing women's hours or not requiring freshmen and sophomores to live in residence halls, or perhaps initiating a visitation program where men could visit women, women could visit men, you can understand some of the grief and some of the difficulties we were undertaking, and I don't think we could have made it without Martha's support, Martha Peterson's support. During the late 50s, women could have men visitors in their room from, I believe, 1 to 3 on a Sunday afternoon. And if you look carefully in the student handbooks in residence halls, you will see that there were two rules. One, the door had to be left ajar. And two, 1 foot had to be on the ground at all times. So there are those who would argue with you, we haven't progressed very much since then, but I think we have. So the changes that were made were very difficult. At the same time, we were struggling with changes in student affairs. This was before I became Dean of Students. I left Division of Residence Halls itself in 1966, maybe, to become an Assistant Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs. I left Schlichter Hall in maybe 64 or 65 to move to an office, ironically enough, in Lathrop Hall. I, for 2 years, glorious years, I had an office, the old Dean of Women's office in Lathrop Hall, with wonderful high ceilings and the most luxurious private bathroom I've ever seen. When Joe Kaufman became Dean of Students, at the very beginning of the anti-war movement, Joe was Dean of Students during the Dow riots in Commerce Hall, maybe 67, 68. When Dr. Kaufman decided to leave the University of Wisconsin and become president, I think, of Rhode Island University, Chandler Young, who was then Associate Dean of Letters and Science, was appointed to the Dean of Students position. But they changed the title. So effective in 1969 or 68 or 69, we no longer had a Dean of Students, we had a Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs. And in about 67, 66, 68, somewhere in there, about that time, I became an Assistant Vice Chancellor for Chan Young. And if I jump too far, please hold me back.
We can go back, I've got you.
At that time, in the late 60s, and I didn't become Dean of Students itself until 1970. I was an Assistant Vice Chancellor for maybe three years prior to that time. At that time, we were in the midst of the anti-war protests on campus. the very beginnings of the same. The Board of Regents were not very happy with our disciplinary policies, and I am very critical of the board at that time. I thought they were more interested in body count and statistics than education. That's a strong feeling I had then. Although, in retrospect, some of the members of the board that I respected most were the ones who were the most rigid on disciplinary matters. But at their request, and through the office of chancellor, then Ed Young, on campus, on the Madison campus, the decision was made to appoint a person to handle discipline and take that responsibility away from Chan Young. I might add that one of the things that served as an impetus for that decision was a decision that Chan Young made that I think was the gutsiest, most courageous decision any dean ever made. And I really honor him for this, and I applaud him for this, but it got him in trouble. Sometime in the late 60s, 67, 68, the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh had a riot, had a kind of a midi or mini rebellion, a protest led primarily by black students. The decision of Oshkosh was to expel a number of students, I don't remember how many, but in the tens and twenties, maybe even more, mostly black. A number of them applied for admission to Madison. Chan Young, with wisdom and courage that you don't see very often, agreed to accept those who were academically eligible. And he did it. It was shortly thereafter, by the way, that the regent established a new policy which read very clearly, if you're ineligible to attend one campus, you're eligible to attend them all. But the move was made to appoint a person to handle discipline because of unhappiness the way it was being handled. Many of us opposed that decision itself, ironically enough, that I would eventually end up being in that position. But we also opposed strongly that the position be called Dean of Students. The Dean of Students is not, in our mind, primarily a disciplinary position. It is an educational position, and one of the functions within that system is discipline. But it ended up being appointed and named Dean of Students. And it was, I believe, in August of 1970 that Gene Klingen was named to that position. He tragically died in December, I think, of 70, at which time I was appointed. But a certain irony in that the two of us who most vehemently opposed the position in its inception ended up being in that position. But that was part of the whole struggle to develop a singular student personnel service on campus that included all aspects of student life. I remember when I became Dean of Students and I saw Dr. Kaufman, Joe Kaufman, some years later, and he said to me that the thing you need to do when you're to be successful as a Dean of Students is to ignore the organization chart. That wherever students are, that's your responsibility. Ultimately, as the time passed, it became clear that the Dean of Students position was going to expand. If a person in that position handled only discipline and nothing else, he or she would be busy on Monday morning and that's it. And it did expand to include a lot of counseling, a lot of educational work, and it became, in short time, the Central Student Affairs Office. Then, I think in 1973 or so, when the university faced one of its many budgetary crises, and we were told to come up with a $500,000 savings in student affairs. A number of us on the committee recommended that the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Office be dissolved, and that we simply use the Dean of Students Office as a central student personnel office. And that's when Chan Young went back to Letters and Science, when we made changes in the counseling service, and when a department we now know as Academic Services was created under Joe Corey. Academic Services being those offices whose presence on a campus are always needed, admissions, registrar, financial aid, the like. Mm-hmm. I've digressed, I'm sorry.
No, let's, if you can, first of all, help me figure out how to exactly ask the question and then give me a summary answer. I'm talking about if you could describe in some kind of summary form where student organization or student affairs or dean of students, I don't exactly know how you say it, where they went from the early 50s to the end of the 60s, sort of characterize it in a couple of minutes statement.
There were three stages. If one were to look at the history of student affairs in this campus from 1950s through the present time, there were three stages. One was primarily an administrative programming unit where you administered financial aid, the health service, PNS, police and security, once reported to the student affairs, the unions, residence halls, the fraternity, the Greek system. And you were not really involved in providing direct service. The second stage occurred in the early 70s, at the time that I was in the Dean of Students office, when we became a direct service provider. We emphasized counseling and crisis intervention. We began talking about depression and suicide, eating disorders. We emphasized greatly that mental health of students was inexorably tied, if you please, to their academic health. Subsequently, when I left, the office has again now reverted to a more traditional student affairs where it is a provider of services. It is not a provider of services, but it administers services. I need quickly to add that in spite of maybe the intonation of my voice and where my own biases are, this is not a value judgment of one system being better than the other. The system of crisis intervention and counseling and humanizing a large complex campus reflected my priorities and hopefully my skills. Administration reflected neither. But that's clearly in a summary fashion what happened to student affairs from the mid-50s all the way to the present time. It is now a traditional Dean of Students office. It is now much more traditionally a division of student affairs where a lot of offices report to it and they administer programs. The goal is the same, simply different ways of getting there.
Let's go back to the end of the 50s now and the beginning of the 60s. I have a question. It's not a trick question. I'm curious to what you say. When, in your estimation, did the 50s end and the 60s begin?
I think the 60s began on a sit-down takeover of the administration building by anti-draft protesters. Had we listened more carefully to the protesters of the 50s, we might not have been caught off guard by that. But I think the 60s began probably about that time, 61, 62. Maybe 62 or 63. I think the 60s began at a time when students began to realize that the university as an institution is primarily a reactive, not a proactive. I think the 60s began, again, 62, 63, right early in that decade, when students began to realize that they have some power. I don't believe, by the way, that students ever really understood conceptually the incredible power they had. How they could have closed this university down by simply refusing to pay tuition. But one of the, you know, off and on over the years, there were attempts to form a student union. But one of the criteria for a successful union is you can guarantee what your members will do. And you couldn't guarantee that on this campus. But I think it at least the world for us changed about 62 or 63.
Getting back to that first sit-in, were you involved in that? I mean, were you around?
I was around. I wasn't actively involved, but I was there because students in residence halls were there.
Did you sense in your own head sort of a little power shift or any kind of was any kind of a blip registered within you at that point?
Only in retrospect. I think we then, as a university, made the same mistake with that sit-in, for example, that we made, I more actively involved than others, made in the 50s when we dealt only with the symptoms of the student power movement and didn't look for the underlying causes. If one looks carefully at the underlying causes of that sit-in with a draft in Peterson Building, again, early 60s, I think we would have seen fermentation, the beginnings, and we should have been, in retrospect, more interested in what are these issues, what's this all about? Does it go beyond just the draft and the fact that we have to report your grades as a selective service kind of thing? And I think it did. Fundamentally, people were asking for equal participation in a society. And I think in retrospect also, the black students on campus began to see how progress was being made. I'm convinced, by the way, that most of the things in life can be put into a context. I have good news, I have bad news. The bad news is that we had a lot of protest on this campus, the black students, the anti-war students, the anti-war protest. That's also the good news. They forced us to change. So I have no ill will toward the black students who protested to create some change. I love this university, but I hope I'm being honest about it. We are like a mule, that unless you hit us over the head with a 2x4, you won't get our attention. And the protests were, in a way, hitting us over the head with a 2x4.
You know, it's funny, I'd never thought of it quite this way before, but as you described the sit-ins, in retrospect, the beginnings, I couldn't help but flash on William Styron's excellent book on the Confessions of Nat Turner.
Yes.
And the reason the whites put that rebellion down so quickly is because the slaves at any point in time could have taken over the plantations if they'd have just had whatever, you know, the historical factors that came together. And I could see how, in retrospect, the students, of course, they could have overwhelmed this campus at any point in time. And it just took a series of events before they needed the catalyst to kind of push them into it.
But this campus has always been racially, philosophically, and geographically segregated. I believe we still are, although maybe to a lesser extent. So I don't think students ever had within their community a leader of such incredible charisma and power to bring them all together.
You said that this community has been racially segregated in two other ways, and was and remains. Expand on that a moment, will you?
If one looks at the demographics of the campus, both statistically, but also philosophically, racially, we are not an integrated community. We have many kind of, I believe, to be superficial indices or indications of the community working together. We have a multicultural center now. And the reason for the smile is that the multicultural concept came about because we closed the original Afro-American Center back in the early 70s. But we may want to talk a little bit about that later on. But I don't think we have an integrated community. Attempts have been made the last few years to bring together the Black Greek system and the White Greek system. I don't think it's a very deep integration. If you walk on campus, you will see very few activities involving both Black students and white students. I think, by the way, and again parenthetically, that one of the concerns and legitimate concerns that non-Black minority students have is the tendency of a white administrator to think Black when one thinks minority and not be cognizant of the fact that Chicano students, Asian students, Native American students who have all struggled. An integration. We haven't solved that problem, but this campus is not an integrated campus. I don't believe it to be.
We talked before about, you know, whether if Martha Peterson hadn't come, was it just the times that was ready that were changing, or how much of a catalyst was she? I think we can say the same thing about certain of the historical events, certainly that occurred in the 60s. And we had, as we've all lived through, a series of devastating assassinations and political unrest at the national level that one has to feel had a terrific direct impact on the campus here in Madison. What about, let's talk about the Kennedy assassination, or the Kennedy's assassination for a moment, and the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and of course the buildup of our military efforts in Southeast Asia. Well, let's start with the Kennedy. Can you remember how that impacted? You were directly involved with students at a heavy way that time.
Just a second, we're going to flip.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
No, I got enough water.
Going great. How's it sound, Ralph?
Fine.
Great.
Okay. We're going.
Okay. So let's get back to the 60s. Kennedy.
I, like many, can tell you precisely where I was at the time of the Kennedy assassination. I, like many, can tell you precisely where I was at the time that Robert Kennedy was assassinated in California, or Martin Luther King was shot. The Kennedy assassination, John Kennedy, President Kennedy, had a broad impact on its student life on this campus. For reasons that historians may argue for years to come, whether President Kennedy deserved all the accolades he received, whether he really was about to create Camelot, but this was the belief, this was the assumption, this was the kind of dream that he brought to a lot of young people. So that November day, a Friday, I believe, that he was assassinated in Texas. People cried. Young people were devastated. In our society, young men are not encouraged to cry. On that day, young men cried. Young men hugged. People talked. You walked down the Lakeshore area. Suddenly, the residence halls began to empty out. People were gathering and talking in small groups, large groups. People were pacing. It's as if somebody had blown a dream. Martin Luther King's assassination. Well, let me back up a bit to Robert Kennedy. I don't think Robert Kennedy's assassination had the same impact. My sense was that only the more politically involved students were affected by Bobby Kennedy's assassination. They never saw in him the kind of charismatic leader the man who will take us to the kingdom of heaven, if you please, as they saw in President John Kennedy. Martin Luther King's impact was, I thought, much more restricted, primarily to black students and people of color, and what I found interesting in retrospect, faculty and staff. I need to maybe digress for a bit. You had asked me earlier whether or not Wisconsin is a liberal institution. And I indicated that my thoughts are that this is not a liberal institution. We are primarily conservative, heavily Wisconsin residents. I remember back in residence halls, back in 1955, for example, during the beginnings of the student power movement, residence halls was 99% Wisconsin and 99.9% white. So that when we first began having black students come into residence halls back in the maybe late 50s, early 60s, I remember vividly a young man from Wyoming, Wisconsin, saying, "I've never known a Catholic or a Jew or a black person before. How can you expect me to deal with them effectively now, Paul?"
Hold on a second.
Hold on, something just fell. Are we set? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
You know, the young man from Wyoming back in the 50s who, in effect, shared a lament with me when we were trying to deal with a problem in one of our houses. When he said, "I grew up in Wyoming, Wisconsin. I don't know any Catholics, any Jews, or any blacks. And you expect me to come in and deal with the kind of issues you're posing to us. This is a question of relationships in our residence halls." A lot of our students in this campus did not at that time relate to Martin Luther King, did not understand his powerful impact on the black community, and did not see him, as many others also saw Kennedy, as the person who's going to take us out of the doldrums of our life. Another parenthetical comment, if you look back on residence halls in the 50s, one of our biggest problems there was not the integration of white and black or white and minority, it was the integration of Wisconsin residents and Eastern residents. Because for many years, the only ones in Wisconsin in residence halls were Wisconsin residents because of priority set by the legislature. So when we brought in students from the East or the West or other large urban areas, we really had some integration problems. But coming back to the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, I think John Kennedy's assassination had a profound effect. It brought young people to tears. It kind of pricked the bubble that many people envisioned that life would be with the Kennedys. Robert Kennedy to a lesser extent, and Martin Luther King was limited heavily to the black students, people of color. And I can't speak for anybody else but myself. Until Martin Luther King's assassination, and until I began reading and listening and speaking to my black friends, did I fully understand the powerful force that he was in the black community. So I can't criticize some of the young people.
Now, there was another thing going on that, of course, had a very direct impact on the campus atmosphere, and that was the war in Southeast Asia. When did you start getting wind that there were going to be some real strong things happening, or did the initial protests more or less surprise you?
When I think about the beginnings of those anti-war years, I'm tempted to say in 1856 it began. That's how long ago it seemed. I believe, in retrospect, we were caught off guard. Maybe perhaps going back to the initial draft sit-in when we didn't ask the right questions. Perhaps underestimating or misreading the inclusiveness of this issue. there are rebels on this campus, as there are on, I assume, every campus. And I'm often reminded of the James Dean movie, Rebel Without a Cause. That these are people, and I don't want to do them a disservice or an injustice, because these are, in many cases, young idealists in their own way. But if the U.S. government said Tuesday follows Monday, they would protest. And suddenly the war became their issue. And to the extent that I was surprised at the inclusiveness of the war as an issue in this community, they were even more surprised. They didn't realize until, I think, well into the movement, that they were sitting on a, what for some of them was the ideal issue, because it transcended ideological lines, age lines, political lines, race lines. And they also discovered that the university was slow in learning how to react. That we waited till after the fact to act. A great number of people involved in the anti-war protests were people that I proudly claim as my friends, and people whose judgment I may have occasionally questioned, as they occasionally questioned mine, but whose commitment to end a war that was divisive was deeply felt. The radicals among them were, I'm convinced, the minority of the anti-war movement. One had to only be involved in the Candlelight March in October, maybe 71 or 72, I can't be sure, a Candlelight March from the Athletic Camp Randall Fieldhouse area downtown. David Cooper was there, chief of police, and to look at that crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people and see that there are people who represented every corner and crevice of this community. A lot of us who were products of the Second World War and veterans of the Second World War were slow to come into that movement. A lot of us were slow to understand that this war was different. What it studs, is it Studs Circle? The Good War, the Second World War. The Korean War was a non-entity on this campus. It was a non-issue until Eisenhower announced, I'm going to Korea. A lot of us coming out of the Second World War were always grateful of Eisenhower because he ended the war. A lot of us thought that his reputation was sullied when he became a politician, and I'm going to Korea. A lot of us remember those times, the pre-anti-war years of say, Joe McCarthy hearings. People were obsessed with listening to the radio with the Joe McCarthy hearings. But it does seem to me that we failed to really grasp that this war was different. One could make an argument, maybe not the most persuasive, that we were in Korea to stop aggression. One could make an argument, as I bought into in the Second World War, this was a good war. We were fighting for our civilization. One could not make that argument in Vietnam. And with the advent of the media, the technology, and in spite of my strong feelings about technology, and I have some strong feelings about it, what it fed the anti-war protest years. It fed the people who objected to war all kinds of information that was misinformation from the government. There was a real identifiable moral crusade in the anti-war years. And I respected a number of people who were willing to risk their own freedom and their own future and participate in that movement. I certainly was a very strong opponent of the war. Some members of the regents were upset by that. I remember many years later when the chancellor's office received a call from some anonymous, a woman in Madison, to report that I'd been seen talking to Carlton Armstrong at the airport. Gracious. Excuse me. There are people currently on the faculty and on the staff who are very active in those years. Everything, much of what happened in those years was part of the rebellion that went far beyond the war, the clothing one wore, the marijuana. It seems to me, as you look back in the 1960s, had marijuana not been politicized, it'd be legal by now, along with alcohol. But we learned a lot. The university learned a lot. It learned how to communicate.
Now, you yourself were in a very interesting... Okay. I want some more water. Just let me know. I'll go get you some.
Okay, it's warm in here.
You yourself were in a very interesting position because you were really working for the administration, obviously, yet you had anti-war feelings, you were representing the students to a certain extent against an administration that was in many ways worked against the students. How did all of that work out with you?
Very well. You know, the problems that are posed is, did I, as a dean of students, have difficulty transcending the many roles, being part of the administration that was seen as anti-student by many, being closely tied and comfortably tied with Ralph Hansen in terms of what PNS, police and security, were doing on campus, being an advocate for students, being involved with students day and night. But I don't see that as a contradiction or a conflict. I'd like to believe I was trusted by students. They knew who I worked for. They knew I worked closely and met often daily with Ralph Hansen. They knew that we met daily with Ed Young. They knew that I was opposed to the war. I reminded them often, those who would listen, maybe some who wouldn't listen, of the story of Robin Fleming, who was chancellor for a while on campus, who was severely criticized for bailing out 3 or 4 anti-war protesters from jail. And his answer, I will always remember, when asked why he did that, he simply said, "I can't talk to them if they're in jail." Most of us wondered where he had $1,300 in cash, but that's a whole other issue. And I learned a lot from Ralph Hansen. In many ways, Ralph Hansen would say, if I don't talk to them, I don't know who they are, and they don't know me. I think students knew a number of things when I was dean of students. I believed strongly that suspension or expulsion was our capital punishment, and I would use it with great care and great discretion. Now, mind you, as a matter of policy, I, as dean of students, could never kick somebody out of school. I could only recommend it, but that recommendation carried a lot of weight. I think they also knew that my public statements were consistent with my philosophy that my job was to get kids through the school, not out. And those of us without sin can cast a first stone, and I better not throw very many stones. I also believe strongly, and I hope that that feeling persists today, that we are a strong institution. And if we're going to err, let's err on the side of a student, because we can withstand that. Now, mind you, I had some blind spots. Sexual assault, physical assault were my blind spots. Throwing bombs, firebombs at cars were a blind spot. But other than that, I was a great believer in giving students a second chance. And I look back now, one of the favorite students during the 60s was one of the attorneys in the O.J. Simpson trial. There are two or three members of his faculty and staff, one including in system administration in a fairly significant position, who were disciplined on this campus for their anti-war activities. I have some negative feelings about people, and I won't mention their names. But I have a lot of sympathy and compassion for those who struggle to find a way to hit us over the head with a 2x4 to get our attention. But we learned a lot. We learned to communicate. We learned to listen. We learned that we need to meet students on their turf. The university is primarily an 8-to-4, 8-to-5 institution. Student life begins at noon and goes till 3 or 4 in the morning. If you look back in retrospect on the anti-war years and the protests on campus, and you look back to the chronology and the daily activities, you'll find most protests began at noon on Monday, took a break for dinner, and went through noon on Friday. Seldom, if ever, on weekends, maybe except for the Mifflin parties. We learned to schedule all of our meetings in the early evening when the protests would be quiet. There are people that I know on this campus who still speak angrily and almost hatefully about the anti-war years. Years of rage. They weren't years of rage. But these are the same people who, had they been part of the British Crown in the 1700s, we'd still be members of the British Crown. So that people like Paul Sagan, Eddie Hendel, a lot of others who were the kind of provide an intellectual framework, who attempted to broaden the philosophical context of the anti-war protest. It isn't only the war in Asia. That's a symptom of the way we need to change our structure in society.
Who learned more, you or you and the administration or the students?
There were three periods in my life when I learned the most about myself. One was when I became a house fellow. The second was now that I've retired. Amazing. But the third was during the anti-war years. I learned to listen. I learned in the 60s that which I did not learn in the 50s, to not deal just with the questions, but what is behind those questions. To attend meetings at the union. If somebody, while I was dean of students, would have offered me $1 million, I'd have hired a staff to be on duty at night, to be on campus, to walk around, to be in the union, sit in the Ratskeller, sit in other lounges on campus, and interact with students and learn. But I think we learned a lot from the anti-war years. Certainly we learned some of us refer to as a Dow principle, that Dow Chemical was the company that was recruiting on campus, I think in 1967 or so, in the Commerce Building on the Hill, when we had that horrendous riot, painful riot, unnecessary riot. But I think one of the lessons we learned was that in order to be a deterrent, police needed to be there in advance of what was happening. And the message to students had to be, and Ralph Hansen was superb in giving this message, our police are there is to make sure that peace is maintained. Ralph, it was wonderful having Ralph Hansen in that position, because he was an advocate of free speech. He argued students have a right to be heard, and we ought to damn well listen to them. It wasn't very long ago when Ralph and I had lunch together at the Union. And we were from the Memorial Union on campus. And we were walking back from the Memorial Union to our cars where they were parked. And I would think that in that brief 15-minute interlude, 15 people, students, former students, said hello to Chief Hansen, including some of his bitterest antagonists who are still on campus, you know, who strongly fought him but always respected him. I need to make one other comment, if I can, of a perception, perhaps, that the administration during those days were anti-student. They weren't. One, I'm part of the administration, and I think I know. And I spent enough time with the Ed Youngs and the Irv Shanes and the Len Van Esses and the Ralph Hansons and the Bri Curls, all of them, to know that they weren't anti-student. A lot of pressures we were facing, keep the university going. A lot of political pressures from the conservatives in this community and the state. I don't think I've ever said this publicly before, that in terms of counseling, you discover many fathers and mothers who love their children but don't know how to show it. The sadness of meeting students in their 19s, in their late teens, early 20s, who've never been hugged by their mother or father, who've never been told, I love you. They don't question love is there, but somehow no one has taught the father and mother how to show that love, how to show that great care, that concern. Perhaps many of the administrators I worked with never knew how to adequately clearly show their love and compassion and concern. One of the most moving moments that I can ever recall was in front of Bascom Hall the day that Sterling Hall was bombed. And Fred Harvey Harrington, Eddie Young in tears. Tears reflecting, I'm sure, a whole myriad of feelings, a whole range of emotions. But those tears were real. And one of the primary reflections was, what could we have done to avoid this? Even though, back to I have good news, I have bad news, the bad news, Sterling Hall was bombed and a young life was lost. But in a sense, the good news is that it was for the first time a vivid illustration to so many students on campus as to what violence means. And I'm sure, as certain as I can be of anything, that when you look in retrospect to the beginning of the end of the anti-war movement on this campus, Sterling Hall is certainly that, I think, time.